This is a continuation of the Jesse Haver Butler closing interview, tape 8A. The close of tape 8 was focused on her breastfeeding experiences in London, and she was describing how she had been taught to draw off milk in the morning. This tape continues with that description and also covers her Tavistock experiences and the Fabian summer school experiences. I'll start with how you kept the...
Well, he taught me how to draw the milk off with my hands, not with a machine, and put it into a bottle, and a pure bottle, and cap it and put in the refrigerator. And then at night, at 6 o'clock feeding, when the mother had been very busy all day, and of course I was lucky, I got a good cook and I slept every afternoon. You have to take care of yourself or that milk vanishes.
So this is after you go home.
After you go home. Then when there isn't enough milk at night for the baby, then you get out this bottle out of the refrigerator and warm it up in hot water and give the baby some more. And you put a nipple on, you see, and you haven't got a hungry baby that's crying at night and won't go to sleep.
Now, how long would that milk keep?
Well, it wouldn't keep it just till that afternoon. You'd give it to the baby that night. The milk that you'd drawn off in the morning
was an
excess supply because in the middle of the night you haven't nursed the baby. You don't have to keep it. You had it right there to use for that particular day.
Well, then so that every morning you did this and then you'd have the milk at night.
Then I'd have an extra supply of milk to keep going. It was a marvelous thing. And then secondly, they did something else. That to me was perfectly wonderful system. They also advocated that one day a week you were to go off. You were to have one day off a week because of the strain of nursing the baby. It takes it out of you. And so I went to my woman's club on that day, and on that day the baby was given cow's milk. Or not cow's milk, but a prescribed
formula. You couldn't draw off the milk and keep it for the baby.
Well, no, because I didn't have it. When I'd leave off in the morning to go to the club, I'd leave at 10. I would have just fed the baby, and I didn't have any extra supply. So we had a formula, and so then I would stay down there for lunch and miss the 2 o'clock feeding, then get back in time to get the evening feeding, and then the baby, for that extra time, got used to a bottle so that if anything happened, if you suddenly got ill or suddenly had to end the breastfeeding, the baby didn't feel neglected. But also when you started weaning the baby, you took, there are five feeds, you took five feeds to wean them. You drop one feed 1 week, the next feed the next, and the baby can't count weeks, you know. And they didn't know that that they were getting more and more bottles than they'd gotten all the times when you had your day off. And then the baby never felt that the mother no longer wanted to feed it. But if you suddenly whip the baby off of your breast, for instance, one day I woke up and I was in horrible pain. There was something terrible the matter with one of my breasts. I thought I'd die. It was so terrible. So I got on the bus, rode clear into London, to the breastfeeding clinic. And when I got in there, I said, something terrible's happened. I can't breastfeed that baby. And of course, I had a nurse to give her the formula while I was gone. And she said, oh, Mrs. Butler, we'll take care of that. Don't worry. And what had happened was that one little drop of milk had got stalled in one of the arteries where the milk comes through and had turned sour and clogged the supply of milk. And it was held back, which they call that hardening of the artery in this country. And instantly the baby's taken completely off, just like clockwork. And suddenly this baby can't get its mother anymore. And every child that has that happen has a terrible complex about their mothers that they didn't want to feed them. But this woman gently massaged my breast and loosened that little clog of sour milk, and the milk shot clear across the room and hit the wall when that artery was freed.
Now, was
and
she,
I was all
was
right.
This woman who did this a doctor? Was she
oh,
a nurse?
Oh, no. She was just a skilled mm-hmm. nurse on breastfeeding, mm-hmm. running the clinic. No, they don't. They don't send you to doctors all the time. Women do all of this thing. Oh, the story I wanted to tell you. This woman came over to America, and she lives right here in Pomona. And she had been a nurse and a midwife in London, had a bicycle, and used to deliver 150 babies a year. I said, did you have to have the doctors come and help? I never had to call a doctor. Because you must remember, she said, Mrs. Butler, that those women, those especially those poor class women, who had been going to their woman's clinic all through the months, the 9 months of pregnancy, and she said, those babies just popped out. You never saw anything like it. You just get there, and the baby was there. There was no fear. They knew all about what was going to happen. They were trained. And you never saw babies born so quickly in all your life. So when she married a Jewish scientist and came to New York and he didn't have a job, she went to the leading big hospital in New York where babies were born and got a job there. And on credit of what she'd done in England. Well, one day there was no doctor there when a woman came in and her 12th baby was just about born. So my friend took her to the delivery room and delivered the baby instantly. And when the doctor came back, he fired her. There was a rule, women were not to deliver babies in this country. And he fired her. And she said, what should I have done? And he said, you should have pushed the baby back till I got here. Now that's how modern we are in America. What a horrible thing.
What year was that, Jesse? Do you know about
yes,
what year
it
that
was? Yes, it was about 10 years ago. And then he fired her. And she's just eager now to do some work. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I get on the question of child care mm-hmm. centers, which I'm starting, I'll tell you what I'm going to do with her, too.
Okay, well, why don't we go into that, and then we can go back about the Fabians is the only other thing I want.
Would you rather finish up the Fabians and me in London?
Okay. Well, tell me a little bit about the Tavistock Clinic, too.
Yeah, well, you see, at Smith College, I was fortunate to have one of the first courses in psychology in America. And in all my college work, this was the thing that rang a bell. I was crazy about it, and so I took everything in that department, all the advanced, I took a whole course in philosophy, aesthetics, ethics, logic, everything that they had. And but the course in psychology, I took 2 years of that, and I was just alerted, and of course, and with my background, you can imagine why I would have been, having had this early childhood background that was so unexplainable. And so when I got to London, I read right away about a Tavistock clinic that met every month and that was run by Jones, the man who wrote The Life of Freud, and Hadfield, James J. Hadfield, who was the Jungian. And over there, the Freudians and the Jungians don't fight as they do in this country. They work together and they're very harmonious. And these two men established a Tavistock clinic where people could go and hear lectures on psychology, on mental cases, and all the kind of things that are concerned with that subject. So immediately I went down and joined this clinic. And for a long time I went to their lectures, and they were, of course, just fascinating. And I said to myself, if I ever get into trouble, I know who to go to, and that'll be Hadfield. I just didn't care for the Freudian philosophy. I felt it was narrow and didn't suit my type of thinking. And sure enough, when after I'd had this terrible miscarriage, and then I finally had my little daughter, and I commenced to have terrible mental depressions. I could hardly take care of her. I only had 2 days to take care of her when the nurse was gone. And one day, when I was pushing her down to Golders Green, where everybody took their children in the afternoon, I found myself wanting to push that little girl in front of a streetcar and get rid of her. And I was horrified. And so I went to Hadfield at once and said, there's something wrong with me. Of course, I didn't know any. All this background was gone, you see. And so he was very cool about taking me on. I was then 33. I was then nearly 40 years old. And he did not like taking women as old as that. And I said, why? And he said, well, the minute things get difficult, they drop out and I have an unfinished case. And I said, doctor, you don't need to worry about me. You take me on and I won't drop out till I find out what's wrong with me. Because in the state of mind, I'm going to have a mental place and stay there. But that won't do me any good because as soon as I get home under my burden, I'll be bad again. And I'm not fit to take care of that child that I should have such an impulse as that. And, he'd think it over, he said. He'd have to think it over. And for 3 months, I called him almost every day for that appointment. He did that on purpose to see how determined I was, you see.
Now, did you stay as depressed during those whole 3 months?
Oh, yeah, terrible. And I tried to have as little to do alone with that child as I could. And, of course, I got alert on how careful I had to be, but I saw that I was afraid to take care of her, that there was something in me that was antagonistic to the whole deal. And finally, he gave me a date. And finally, he gave me a date, and he told me to, gave me a certain time to come and see him. At that time, I was still reading Christian Science. I had to have some spiritual thing to hang on to. So on the way down to the date, I went into Christian Science reading room. There was a lovely one on Oxford Street in London, and spent 2 hours reading those lessons. I was so frightened. I knew it was going to be a terrible experience. And pretty soon then I saw his office, and when I got to the head of the stairs where his office was, I pretty nearly fainted dead away. I was so terrified, and yet I knew I must do what he said or he wouldn't keep me. And so he told me to lie down on the couch, as they always do, and he sat up near the end, and he was this very quiet type of man that's so good at that work. And he said he wanted me to lie down, and he wanted me to close my eyes and try to think of myself as a little baby and tell him what I saw. And I said to myself, I won't do it. And then I said to myself, yes, you will do it. You will never be able to bring up that baby that you wanted if you don't find out what's wrong with you. You've got to do it. All this went on in my mind. So I closed my eyes and I just let go, you see, as you can. And I started to cry. And I had never cried in my life like that. In fact, I used to wonder. I never cried. I'd go to movies. I'd go anywhere. Nothing got a tear out of me. And for half an hour, I thought I'd die. I felt every bone being pulled apart, every nerve being stretched. It was not a physical suffering. It was a spiritual suffering. Undescribable. You cannot describe what it was like. And I just went on and cried loudly and just let it go. And then all of a sudden, after I'd let this go on for half an hour, I sat up and laughed, and I said, well, did you know that was going to happen? Well, not quite so soon, he said. He said he had people come sometimes 4 months before they go like that. And then he said, now I want you to lie down and tell me why you are crying. And as you know, probably, the fact of pain keeps back the truth, you see. Once I let the pain out, then. And I lay down, and I saw I was a little baby, 6 months old, lying on my mother's lap, only her lap was steel, a sheet of steel. And I was suffering like that for love. And I wasn't getting any love at all. We wouldn't get on the sheet of steel. And without love, a child like that's just like somebody without air or sun or water. You can't live without love. And this is how the absence of love could make anybody suffer, you see. And I saw that, and I described it to him, and I said, imagine, I could see that baby just as plain as if she was right there in the room, right with me. I could, of course, it's not a miracle anymore to know that in our souls there is a record of our lives, but we didn't know it then, that you could bring back into memory the memory of a child 6 months old. We didn't know that. So anyway, from then on, the agony of that early pioneer life commenced to evolve rapidly. There was no hesitation. nothing could have been as bad as that anyway. Mm-hmm. And the every meeting, I would have some horrible experience, emotional experience, and I'd come staggering home. I could hardly get home. And there at the window was my little girl waiting for me. How could I give her any love after what I'd just been through? I could hardly get home. And there she was standing at the window waiting for me to come back. So you can see what it did for her. Mm. There was just nothing I could do.
Now you went for 4 years, Jesse?
4 years, three times a day. And all my working life, I had saved money and put it in the home savings bank. And I had hours. And I said to my father, to my husband, now, you aren't going to have to pay for this. I have it. If I don't pay for this, I can't raise this child. I won't be a normal woman. And he said, that's all right. Go ahead. And I used all of it, practically.
Now, did you wait till after you were done before you had your son, or was your son born while you were still in this analysis?
I'm mostly done. Uh-huh. Mostly done. But the interesting thing was, I found out then, years later, why I was lying on a sheet of steel. On my way back, I stopped in Nebraska, where my mother's younger sister was. And I knew that she knew something about my mother. But the Germans are very funny. When things are not very pleasant, they just are so ashamed they won't talk about it. They just conceal it. And I just hounded her all the time I was there. I want to know about my mother. And she said, well, she was queer. Your mother was, I've told you that before. I want to know what made her queer. What I know, I think I know what happened. When your father put you and my mother in an orphanage while he went back to Germany to get another wife, as he did. His younger children he put with farmers, but evidently nobody wanted these older girls, see? When he put you in that orphanage, I said, orphanages must have been a terrible thing in that day and age, in that state. I want to know what happened. And finally, she told me that my mother had been raped when she was 12 years old. So she was frozen emotionally. And that was the answer. And I was certainly grateful that I got that out into the open that explained what was the matter with her. Because any girl, and that's what happens to a child that age, that gets to understand what it's all about, and that's what happens. They freeze up emotionally, and unless they can get to a psychologist or something, they can't uncork. And that's why, a few years later than that, this was just when I was 6 months old, and when I was about 4 years old, I was so agonized for my mother to kiss me. She thought, a lot of women still believe that if you kiss children a lot, you arouse them sexually. They still believe that. It's a common belief yet. That you mustn't fondle and kiss little children too much, or you'll make them have sex feelings, see? And she evidently had that feeling, having had that experience. So I climbed up on the kitchen table and threw my arms around her to hug her, and she pushed me off of the kitchen table, and I fell against the corner of the stove. And I still have the dent right in here on my head, you can see it. That was caused by her pushing me off like that. She was afraid to give me any emotion, and I was so aggressive and so hungry for emotion, you see, because I have a lot of love in me, and I wanted to get some of it, you see. So that's the way it worked out.
So after the 4 years, though, you felt much better about yourself when you were able to go along and okay?
No, I didn't. I had some other horrible experiences. I don't think I better go in.
No, I mean after the 4 years with this doctor then.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. I commenced to feel better right away. Gradually, I understood about the way I felt about my daughter. Mm-hmm. And he didn't get at the kernel of my trouble, though, as my religious teacher has done. Mm-hmm. She's done it. She's really got to the bottom of it because she's brought in reincarnation, which is mixed up with it, too. You see, I've been a man in several lives, so that made things complicated. But I did. I commenced to be normal and take care of my children. And by the time I'd finished with him and got back here, that's why I've been such a howling success as a teacher. I know so much about the fact of how you're affected psychologically teaches you how other people are affected. And I've just been a miracle worker as a teacher of speech, and I lay it all to that psychoanalytic background, that I could sense what was bothering people. I've got a lot of ESP in me, evidently, and I can just put my finger right on the thing and unlatch it often. And so I really owe my life to him.
Well, Jesse, why don't you tell me just very quickly about the Fabians, because we want to have enough time to talk about the child care.
Yeah. How so much more time do we have?
We have about 20 minutes just. So just tell me quickly.
You read that article that I gave you about the Fabians.
Yeah, and we also had, before we talked about it a little bit, so just tell me how you got involved with that.
Well, when I worked in Boston, all those years with the Massachusetts Minimum Wage Commission, there was a strange man in there that in Boston who knew about the Fabians and formed the Fabian Society. And I immediately joined it and became the secretary of the Fabian Society. And I was so fascinated with them because I couldn't talk. Seems hard to believe. I could talk privately, but I couldn't talk in front of an audience because I didn't know the skill. So I was the secretary, and I thought, well, if I go long enough here, I'll learn. Well, I didn't. I couldn't express myself at all. But I learned a lot because we had a lot of lectures about the whole Fabian program. So as soon as I got to London, I hunted up the Fabian Society, where they'd been in operation. Then they changed the whole British government, you know. Mm-hmm. They saved England, especially those three people, Bernard Shaw and the Webbs. And so I went down into their office, and I had a personal letter of introduction to the Webbs from a man, American man, who knew them very well. But Hugh wouldn't let me give them to them because he said, we don't know them very well yet, and we better wait till we do that. And so anyway, he said, well, the Fabian Society has a summer school. And we all go down to this beautiful place in south of England to a girls' private school and have our summer school on the grounds of this school. And I signed up at once, of course.
How long was this summer school? How long did it last?
Mm-hmm. Either a month or 2 months. Mm-hmm. I think it was just a month. And I signed up at once. And, of course, when I heard that Bernard Shaw always came and would be there, and Marie Stopes and many people in the House of Commons, of course. Well, my husband wasn't at all interested. He was rather bored with the idea, but thought it would be fun to be down there. And so I signed up, and it may have been the second year we were in London, when, because I hadn't had any children yet, when I went and I sat at the table with Bernard Shaw. I was considered the honor guest because I was American, the only American practically that had ever gone to Fabian Summer School. So anyway, I sat at the table with Bernard Shaw, and I was so, seems hard to believe, but I was so overwhelmed with the honor of all these people that I didn't talk at all. I didn't have much to say, just sat and watched them and listened. And I'm, that's something I had knew how to do then anyway. But anyway, so finally they said, began asking me about prohibition, which the British thought was a perfectly terrible, undemocratic thing to tell people what they could drink. And so did I know anything about, oh yes, I know all about it, I said. Would I give them a lecture on it? Yes, I said, I would. And I decided that I wouldn't promote prohibition. I'd tell how it happened, because I knew that they had read, that none of them had ever studied any American history at all. So I got a history book from the embassy, started reviewing our history, and of course I was right in the midst of it. And so I started this talk on how prohibition came about in the United States, with Bernard Shaw sitting right here next to me, who was a teetotaler and a vegetarian, and commenced to chuckle and giggle from the minute I started to speak. And all I did was just tell about our history, our immigration, our mixed population, the roughness and of the pioneer life and the saloons and how they dominated it, and the only way that the women could get churches and schools and civilization in there was to get rid of this drink, which was utterly dominating the whole place. And as people could see from the movies, just what it was like. Well, when I got through, there's nothing the British love more than to destroy a speaker. And they all went after me with questions. And I just answered every question with another bump of history. I just poured in the history. So when the session was over, I was still in control of the situation. So they decided to have a second lesson. of history, of questions. And so I did, and I got through that with flying colors. So they had a third question. They were determined they were going to destroy me and my talk. And I got along all right until in the middle. And there was a nasty little man that I thoroughly disliked who came down there to find somebody to sleep with, and utterly immoral type of man. And he had asked some of the worst questions, and suddenly he asked me a question that floored me. It was mixed up in some deep way with England's tradition that I didn't know. And so I just stopped to think and wait, and suddenly I heard my mouth open and answer that question, and I didn't know where I got those words or that answer. And it wrecked this man. In fact, the whole place screamed with glee, including Bernard Shaw. And he met me outside, and he said that he had written two books on America. And I said, well, how long were you there? Oh, I wouldn't go to that country if you paid me $1 million. That's a crazy country. I don't have to go there to write books about them. And so I knew that if he had a dagger, he'd have used it. Because he was ruined. I ruined him. In fact, he left the Fabian Summer School and was never heard from again, as far as I know. And
now, Jesse, how did this...
Wait a minute. In telling this story, 3 years ago, I was still, as I've always been, in mystery, how I knew. And I knew Bernard Shaw was ESP, through ESP, gave me that answer. Mm. And then I had one more lecture with the Fabians. Did you want me to tell you that?
Which one was that?
Well, that was two years later. A man named St. John Irvin was a playwright, and he came to New York to get his play over, and the Fabians hated America, where they were jealous of us. They founded the London School of Economics, and they had all kinds of lectures against America in that school. They didn't know anything about us, so it was a ridiculous attitude they took. So when St. John Irvin came back, not having sold his book, why, they had the Fabians called a big meeting in Essex Hall, where they met, to get his report on America. And so I saw it in the paper, and I said to Hugh, I'm going down to that meeting. I want to go to that meeting. And he said, I'm not going to go. He said, I know what you'll do. You get up and start talking. First thing you know, I'm going to be out of a job. Because no wife of me in the embassy had ever talked in England before. So he stayed home, and I sat right down in the middle of this big hall. And he gave this frightful talk on America. The one thing that was devastating, he said, he got to talk about our literature. Now let's see what literature America's had. And he started in with the Elizabethan era, and of course from then on Whittier and Longfellow and a few poets and philosophers, and that's all. And then he started reading all the literature that England had written in all that period. And he said, you see, we were an uncultured, unlettered nation. And then he described the hotels, how that the doors of every hotel they had still had spittoons right by the doors. They were those sand affairs there, you know. And how, this was right after World War I, how the plates came out swimming in butter and how we were wasting our food, which was the truth, of course. But anyway, I couldn't take any more, so I got up. And I started to talk about the Elizabethan era and how in that era there were only 1,500 white people in this country. I had just gotten those facts. And I said they were so busy keeping alive and having something to eat, they didn't have time to write Shakespearean plays. And then I described the building of this country from the Atlantic to the Pacific in 200 years, a miracle of creation that had gone on, and there hadn't been much time to take care of these humane things. But if they would just wait long enough, we would soon have creativity going in America, and they'd be surprised at how much of it we had from all the nations that had come to settle our country. Well, I brought down the house. And then St. John Irvin's wife got up and tried to pull the speech together again. But it was like Humpty Dumpty. It was gone. So when I got to the door, there was the secretary, and he said, oh, Mrs. Butler, that was just great. He said, I don't think St. John Irvin will ever make that speech again. And all the Americans in the balcony above, none of whom had got up and said a word, came down and congratulated me. So I didn't speak very well. I hadn't had any lessons. But it was a thrilling experience, mm-hmm. And it's something that needs to be done more and more when we get more training of our people to teach them how to speak.
Now, Jesse, how was the school run? Did the people who went to the school run it communally? Or
well, they were always members of the Fabian Society, mm-hmm. paying members. And all through the years, Bernard Shaw was the principal speaker and was so popular, he didn't take any fees. But do you know, I followed him all over London for years. I have never heard such speeches in my life. It was like hearing a great orchestra. It was just like great music. You couldn't forget for weeks what he'd said and the way he'd said it. And he was a mouthpiece for the Fabians. And Webb was the creator of their program, and Beatrice Webb was the writer of their books. Mm-hmm. Now, those three people worked as a communal group, and they created constructive programs for England on poverty and all their terrible problems, so that the English government today has been completely changed largely through those three people. They made the contribution. Their rule was they were not in it for personal glory. They were in it to save England. And they were to get out theories and political policies and political philosophies so that the people could learn gradually better ways to run their country. And they did it. They created the party entirely. Mm-hmm. But they never got the personal credit for it. They never had any personal jobs. But in the end, at all, except towards the end, they commenced to wake up to what a great man this Sidney Webb was. He was a quiet little mousy man, and the big authorities in England commenced going to him for advice. But they didn't. They were a long time before they did that. And now I'd like to just say a word about Annie Besant. She was the only woman in this triumvirate of three men that did a lot of speaking and was very brilliant. And so she was on the newspaper that Bernard Shaw was on in those days. And so when Madame Blavatsky's book came out, who was one of the first metaphysical teachers and writers, he gave Madame Blavatsky's book to Annie Besant to review. And up to that time, she was an atheist. She ceased to be an atheist. She left the Fabians because of that book, Annie Besant's book. And in the end, she founded all the theosophical societies all over England and India. One of the most brilliant women in England. And when she was over 80 years old, she gave a whole series of lectures at Queen's Hall in London. I attended them all. Mm. And I have never heard such lectures in my life. But there was something about her. She was the one, of course, who launched this man in Ojai, who was to be the great prophet of the future. And his story was just recently in the L.A. Times. I don't know. There was something about her that didn't attract me personally. I didn't want to join one of those philosophical societies. But I read all her books. I listened to all her lectures. And in the end, when Annie Besant was dying, she took her into her home and took care of her until she died. But Annie Besant felt that she had wrecked her program by watering it down. But Annie Besant could never have started all those metaphysical, philosophical centers all over the world the way Annie Besant did. She couldn't have done it. Mm-hmm. She was an erratic, odd woman. Mm-hmm. And her book is, if you ever see her book in the library, you can hardly understand it. Mm-hmm. But she was the first breeder of philosophical, metaphysical thinking in the world and started what's now going on in the future.
Okay, well, I think, Jesse, that we have just a few minutes, and we should try and end now with your current work in the childhood.
Well, you remember that what I did in the meatpackers industry, I have somehow had the vision to do something about this child care program. The president, the women in Washington, gave a bill to the president of millions of dollars to start child welfare centers. We don't start things like that. When our great farms were started, the government didn't buy all the farms and start running them. They let the farmers own the farms, and they sent out teachers to teach them how to make those farms work. And that's why we have the big Department of Agriculture and why we've been the greatest industrial farming country in the world is from that. So we have to do the same with children. And the thought came to me with these tracts, that's the place to start your childcare centers. you're going to need them in the centers of the cities for the poverty people. But the middle-class, cultured people need child care centers. There's where the leaders of this country come from, is from the middle classes, mostly. And so I got the idea that we must get after these tracts as they are built and put in child care centers right at their back doors, so the mothers can take the babies to the center and right close to where they live and get them at night. How to pay for it? The people who build the centers have got to build the child care center as an addition, as a lure to people to buy houses. When you say to people, we have a child care center in our tract, why, then they're going to buy those houses, because the women are crazy for child care centers, because 40% of the women in America today are working outside their homes, and they're going to go right on doing that. There's no use telling them to stop it. They aren't going to stop it. So anyway, I started talking to the people in Pomona where that great Phillips Ranch is developing. They've now built 55 houses up there, and they're now going to build 88 more houses. And the thing to do is to get a good child care center started right in this beautiful area up on those beautiful hills, get it going, and get the firms that are building the houses to build the center, get Heidi in Sacramento, who is head of the Status of Women Commission, to send down the rules and regulations of what that center should look like. Don't pay for it, they just what it looks like. And then the women that put the babies in there will have to supervise the people who run it. And they pay for it because they have to pay for child care in their homes. They have to pay put their babies. So no expenses to the state or anything. And it's close at hand, handled by us, close at hand. Everybody thinks it's a great idea. And in this state, in the next year, they're going to build 2,000 child care tracts. Well, they've got to have a child care center in every tract and a playground. Up here on the Phillips Ranch, they don't need a playground because they've got those great high hills where the children can romp over those, and some have some small playgrounds in their backyard. And so Aid Wright, who's a close friend of mine, and Hughes, lives on the edge of this big hill, this big Phillips Ranch, and he's thrilled over it. And Jerry Shepherd, a black man who's a teacher down in Chino, where all those delinquent boys are, 1,000 boys, now been made chairman of the planning commission by Lapeer. Brownell, the awful mayor, has been thrown out. They've got a great new mayor named Lapeer. He was the head of the child care center of the planning commission, and he got this Jerry Shepherd to be chairman of it, and I went over and saw him the other day, and he's thrilled with this. So I called Heidi in Sacramento, and she says that the Status of Women Commission has endorsed the idea of putting child care centers in tracts. Of course, they've got to have them down in the slum centers, and the state will have to build those and start them to help the slum people, or the mothers who are on welfare to get jobs, and they can have a place to leave their babies. And so Jerry Shepherd is going to let me know as soon as he's ready to have a hearing in the City Hall of Pomona, great big new City Hall, and I'm going to get the representatives of all the women's organizations to fill that room and endorse this idea. And if that planning commission orders those people who are building those houses to put in a child care center, they've got to do it or they won't get their houses built. Isn't that mm-hmm. great? And we're going to have a model child care center up there with all kinds of publicity, costing the state nothing except the supervision of the people who run the center. And so Heidi has sent me a whole book on child care centers. She, in 1968, she had a big hearing there. She's got all the rules and regulations in there. She had all the top people in that, telling what the child care centers must have, what the people who run it must have, what kind of background they must have. And she's, that's all there. I gave this to Jay Shepherd, the other day in my interview, and I've sent now for 12 more copies. And that night I went to the first board meeting of the League Voters, who've all statewide have endorsed this child care center, but they didn't say where. And at their board meeting they passed a resolution to help, and they all be there to endorse it. So that's my new job. I am now secretary of the committee on child care of the National Organization of Women of Pomona Valley.
So now you're going to really devote your energy within everything. The movement, within the women's movement, to the child care issue.
Yep. And once we get that child care center going, we'll get nationwide publicity, because it's the only practical way. Everybody I've talked to about it is thrilled. They say it's absolutely right, and that's the way to do it. And to have the president pass $4 billion to build child care centers is not the way America does things. We do them locally, under supervision of the state or the nation. And so I'm just thrilled to death, and I've done it before, and the National Organization of Women here are a little nervous about it, and am I qualified to do this? But nobody else wants to do it but me, and nobody else has the time and leisure to do it but me. And so I'm going to get away with it. And Susanna Hughes and her husband, she's the president of the NOW of Pomona Valley, are both the one thing they're hot about is this child care center. And she says this is an action thing. We've been having meeting after meeting of philosophy. Now we're going to do something. So it'll be our initiative that'll start it, and we'll get all these women's organizations to come and endorse it. So I'm just thrilled. I never thought I'd find myself another job, but I found it.
And I'm sure you'll succeed.
Well, I'll do the best I can. It's going to be very difficult. The so-called beautiful women will all be there to kill it, you know. You know who they are, the beautiful women. Those are the women that think the women should stay home and take care of their children, and they formed a big organization.
Oh, that fascinating womanhood.
The fascinating womanhood. They'll be there. They're the ones that sent the pink silk pillows to every man in the state legislature who voted against Equal Rights Amendment. And they are organized to the teeth.
Have you had encounters with them over this yet?
Not personally. Oh, no, they don't know we're doing. And I don't want, this won't go into any publicity now. I don't want anybody to know it yet till we get our hearing. And so Aid Wright, who is on the city council and is thrilled over it, and an old friend of ours. You see, Hugh and I saved the Phillips Ranch for Pomona, and everybody knows that. So I have a name connected with it. Just heaven sent. Just heaven sent. So Aid Wright, I went to see him and his wife and told him about the fascinating, beautiful women and all. And so when it comes before the city council, and also I told the Shepherd, the chairman of that committee, about them. He has three little black children that he adopted. And he's the most enlightened black man I ever talked to. He's just as good as anybody could be. Very intelligent, very brilliant. That's why LaPierre got him, the chairman of this committee. And he's going to work with us night and day on it, because if we get that child care center in there, those houses will sell like mad. And now, it'll give nationwide publicity.
When is the hearing going to be?
We don't know.
But it's going
to
be soon.
He has to decide that. It must be soon, because they're now getting their ordinances on the building of these houses. And if once those ordinances pass the Planning Commission, and then the city council, then it's too late. We won't get them in. We've got to get them in now. I'd like to take you out there and show you this area while you're here. I really would like to. It won't take very long. If you can drive me out, I want you to see a few of the houses. And that while I was out there the other day, I went up into another area. The three of them got keys, so we can look at them. The cheaper ones are just $23,000. Now the 88 houses are going to be two stories, because Pomona has no nice houses, and all the embryo leaders that come to Pomona have to go to Claremont and Upton to get good homes. So they're going to have a lot of good homes there, and they aren't built. But I'd like to take you out and show you this area, because I want you to know about it, so when we do hit the news, you can tip off the L.A. Times about it for me.
Okay.
So we can eat, and we can go over and see the bloomer lady. That won't take you long. And then you let me drive you, or you drive me.
Okay. We'll see what time is getting.
There was a young couple looking at the place, and the girl was black and the man was white. And I told them about child care center. She said, oh, please get them. She has two little boys, 5 and 6, very smart-looking girl, and she's going to have to work to pay for those houses. She said, oh, Mrs. Butler, don't stop. Please stay with it. We need